Now, in the mindset of people, when you say to them religion and spirituality, obviously they're two different things, because we take spirituality to be mysticism and being a mystic.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, being a mystic, you're not just an average religious person. I could be a very religious person applying the laws of Allah to the teeth.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make me a mystic. It doesn't make me an arif, as we say.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so religion itself, applying religion and being that state of piety, like let's say you said taqwa, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would increase your nearness to Him by opening doors to you that they are not available to others. And as you move on that path, Allah mm-hmm. subhanahu wa ta'ala will reveal more and more until you can see how the creation works, for example. You can, you know, as we say, the al-aynul barzakhiyah, your barzakh eye is opened, and then you can see more than what your average religious person would see. And then, so your nearness to Allah, your communication with Allah, your dealing with Allah completely changes. You move a station further. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as if you constantly see Allah in everything, which a religious person might not do, right? For example,
so if we look at mystics
like Ayatollah Bahjat and Sayyid Ali Qadhi and all his disciples, these guys, they went a level higher beyond our understanding, at least our comprehension. We don't know what they saw, we don't know in what realm they're in. Their mind is with you, they're constantly connected to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this kind of, when we come to mysticism and mystics and urafa, this is what people understand, that these guys are, you know, are way higher than you just average. But these people themselves, they would not have reached that stage of mysticism and irfan if they have not taken the road of religious itself, or religion. They would not become urafa if they have not applied religion to the teeth and avoided sin at all costs.
Are you saying that mysticism, irfan, and spirituality is the same thing?
Within Islamic context.
Within Islamic context, to be an Arab is to be a mystic is spirituality. So spirituality is usually dealing with the spirit itself. When you take the spirit a level higher outside the body, that's what spirituality is. So you have the word spirit in the word itself. So you take your ruh, which is your spirit, outside your body to a new realm. And that's obviously spirituality. That's mysticism from an Islamic understanding. Now, from a secular understanding, like let's say, is getting that inner peace, that serenity, and you know, coexisting with the world around you. If you go, for example, if you move into the East, when you go to the Buddhists and stuff, their spirituality is more different than ours and that of the West. For example, they do meditation, they do all this kind of yoga. They also learn how to control matters around them. So, for example, you've seen a lot of Buddhists, for example, they go through walls, they bend metal, they spend days on end, or weeks on end without eating and consuming
food. So, like, in general, when we talk about spirituality, it's not necessarily reaching Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, God.
So exactly. So you have to define it. So you have to define spirituality from whose perspective? A Western perspective, an Eastern perspective, an Islamic perspective. So from an Islamic perspective, like they say, it said, you could never be a mystic or arif unless you are extremely religious. I remember one of my teachers in the house, they said, I want to Ayatollah Bahjat. And we said to him, Sayyidina, give us some dhikr, teach us something to, you know, get moving. He said, in which level are you guys in the house? They said, we are in the first level and we're constantly fasting, constantly. He said, you know what, go break your fast. Forget about Irfan. First, go learn your fiqh, learn your jurisprudence. And once you master everything, then come back to me for dhikr.
So what you're trying to say is like
mastering,
we need to
this mastering has a meaning, you know. Uh-huh. Master everything means practically apply everything.
Exactly. So you can't...
Because in the mysticism, the mystics, the urafa, they said, if you want to become an arif, you do not need to go and learn like many books or all the rules of jurisprudence even. We have these statements as well. They said, the amount of religion that you know, if you're practically living according to those amount of religion that you know, you will have a rank, spiritual rank for yourself.
So it's like we need to abide to all the wajibats and halal.
Yes, definitely, definitely. We need to be very much careful about these things. One more thing, we have obviously, because you know, in the Muslims, obviously within them there were many converts in the beginning of Islam and all those times. So we can see some deviated groups as well, who within Islam separates religion from the spirituality, like Sufis. Like the Sufism is something like they totally talk about the kind of spirituality which we see in Buddhism and Hinduism.
Okay.
And they apply that within Islam. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them say, like, there is no need of praying Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah is within you. You know, these are the ideologies have. So they get separate from this world and all those things. I just remember of one of the, you know, historical stories by Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, the fourth Imam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. A lady came who was a monk.
Mm-hmm.
And she came to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, the fourth Imam, and she said that Allah has given me these ranks. Uh-huh. Spiritually, I have reached to this level that I can move this and that, and I have these extraordinary powers that Allah has given me. And I got this because I never got married. I never had kids. I never had a headache of getting involved into this worldly life.
Mm-hmm.
Imam Zainul Abidin replied to that lady, and he said that if this was the case, that Allah has set such a condition or such a way in order to get to the high ranks of spirituality, then Allah wouldn't make Hazrat Fatima al-Zahra Sayyidatul Nisa al-Alameen, the master of all the ladies of the Alameen, of the world. So she had kids, she had a husband, she had a father, she was living in the community, and she served her household. Mm-hmm. And while these things never stopped her from reaching to the most highest level of spirituality.
Yeah.
So the spirituality within Islam, the actual translation or the definition of spirituality is, you live your life and you never disobey Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Dear listeners, it's a good time for having a second break, so we'll be right back shortly.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We have to act upon the things we know. It sounds so simple, but in reality it isn't. Like,
well, that's the whole idea, is that when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about piety, for example, that you need to be a muttaqi, that you need to constantly protect yourself, that's the case. But as a human being, because we are humans, and that's why it's called dunya, because it's low, and we have this connection to this dunya, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we made from this earth itself. So there's a connection between us and earth, which means that I am constantly connected to my desires.
Yeah.
So sometimes when it comes to me and my world, it's always a constantly a battle whether I should indulge in the things that I need and want, or should I refrain. So it depends on how well educated you are in the Islamic field and how much you know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and how much willpower you have into controlling yourself. For example, sometimes you see yourself as some sins, you control yourself perfectly, you have no issue. As some cases, you fail.
Mm-hmm.
So that obviously depends on your willpower and depends on how much you know. The less religious person you are, the obviously the more sins you have. Obviously, that's not always the case, because sometimes you have someone who reached a marja, like Ashal Ghamani, who was at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam in the minor occultation. And when he reached a point, he wasn't appointed as an ambassador. He went and he started saying all the things that made the Imam alayhi salam curse him. Where Ashal Ghamani, they said his books were like Arsala al-Amaliya today, was in every Shia house back in the day. So sometimes you could reach that level, but you can still fail. So the idea is how much you know religiously and how much you control yourself.
Okay, so
sometimes that's the case. I find the sin, I don't have that self-control, I indulge in it, and there you go.
So thank you so much, brothers. That's all the time we have for today. Inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to get closer to Him. And with that being said, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabbal Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again. Once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Afghans witnessed their most difficult days, the 12th round of Iranian aid to Afghanistan arrived in Kabul. These batches, including 5 tons of medicines and 5 tons of food, are meant to treat injuries and be distributed to the families of victims of Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Iran's been sending a series of humanitarian aid to Afghanistan since the beginning of the recent crisis in the country, at the recommendation of the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to help our brothers. This current shipment will target those who were injured and lost their beloved ones in the recent Daesh terrorist group attack on Sardar Mohammad Dawood Khan Hospital in Kabul.
Taliban officials welcome emergency aid to the country and thank those who stay by the Afghan side in the darkest days. People suffering from poverty and difficulties await more help from the world countries.
We thank Iran for its humanitarian aid to our people. May God give them in return. Iranian aids have always been on time, especially when they helped us with emergency aid after 2 large mosque blasts. Today, our people in a critical situation and need help. So the world countries should help us and free our frozen assets.
The recent crisis largely affected our poor people. We don't have anything to eat or treat our patients. My brother is injured. Now he is under treatment here. Neither the hospital has enough medicines, nor do we have enough money to buy them from outside.
At least 25 people were killed and more than 50 wounded when Daesh terrorist gunmen attacked the 400-bed Sardar Mohammad Daud Khan Hospital after 2 heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. Daesh attacks come as hunger crises are looming in the country. Some countries, including Iran, have been sending shipments of aid. However, to address the problem of hunger in Afghanistan, more international assistance is needed. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Furious students gathered outside the London School of Economics on Tuesday to condemn the university after its debate society invited Israel's UK ambassador to speak at an evening event. The university claimed the event is meant to encourage discourse about the Middle East, but a large number of Muslim and pro-Palestine students are having none of it.
These students are not just angry at the fact that the Israeli ambassador is speaking here today, but they're also venting their frustrations at the university and the debate society as well. They say that by inviting the ambassador to speak here today, they've essentially platformed racism and Islamophobia.
Appointed in 2020, Israel's Zippy Hotovely has been condemned over past comments she made targeting Arabs and Islam. She once reportedly denied Palestine's existence and famously said the Nakba was a great Arab lie.
This is against what the student body wanted. For this university, all the students here are deeply ashamed. This university has failed to recognize and represent the student body.
Someone like this person doesn't really deserve the right to speak about them. She has made comments dehumanizing an entire people. If she can dehumanize people and invalidate their right to speak, why should she have any sort of rights?
So she's actually a preacher, a hate preacher, legitimizing killing children, legitimizing destroying Palestinian hope, legitimizing the expansion of settlers, brutally destroying the crops and everything of the Palestinian.
We as a Jews, we feel obliged to stand up against this racist, against this fascist, and what she presents and who she presents. And we want to encourage the students to come out again in the open for justice, for peace.
Despite the backlash and a walkout staged by students inside the debate hall, the talk went ahead. The Palestinian ambassador will also speak, but at a separate event on the 11th of November. But that hasn't been enough to calm the students' anger. Robert Carter, London.
Since February, there has been calm at the line of control, a de facto border that divides Kashmir between India and Pakistan. But despite relative peace at the border, the situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir is precarious. There have been daily reports of human rights abuses.
The people of the occupied territory continue to suffer under India's brutal military siege. Extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and detention of Kashmiri youth, harassment, and custodial torture continue with impunity while fundamental freedoms are suspended and Hurriyat leadership remains incarcerated.
Against this backdrop, a special envoy of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or OIC, is visiting Pakistan. His visit is aimed at getting the first-hand account of the ground situation of the disputed territory. The special envoy met Prime Minister Imran Khan, who briefed him about the current situation in the Indian-administered Kashmir. But the public opinion is divided over the role of OIC on Kashmir.
I feel OIC has played no significant role in the resolution of the Kashmir dispute. The OIC has not pursued the issue at the international level.
Major problem in Pakistan.
Kashmir is a major problem between the two countries. Except for passing a few resolutions, the OIC has not done enough for the Kashmir cause. It should play a more proactive role.
In an official statement, the OIC special envoy expressed Islamic world's abiding solidarity and support to the legitimate Kashmiri struggle for their right to self-determination as enshrined in the relevant UN Security Council resolutions. Kashmir is at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan for over 7 decades. Both countries claim the region in full, but rule only parts of it. While Pakistan has granted access to the OIC special envoy to its part of Kashmir, India has barred international delegations from visiting its part of Kashmir. This, Pakistan says, highlights Indian effort to hide human rights abuses in the disputed region. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Senior military commanders parade and salute army soldiers as the last phase of a 3-day maneuver codenamed Zulfaqar 1400. The military exercise engaged the 4 branches of the Iranian army and was held over a 1 million square kilometer area, stretching from the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean. Army commanders say the drill was a success and it carries regional and global messages.
The Islamic Republic has in recent years proved that it can be the axis of regional security, which entails a collective regional cooperation. If regional states join hands, they can protect the security of the region without the need to rely on foreigners. History has shown that foreign countries would never bring sustainable security to any nation.
The massive drill kicked off on Sunday with surface and subsurface vessels, air and naval flights, radars and missile systems. The Army also deployed its latest combat and reconnaissance drones, which are produced domestically. The Islamic Republic takes great pride in indigenizing its defense arsenal against the backdrop of an all-out sanctions regime by the U.S. that blocks Iran's access to even a bullet from other countries.
The Iranian army is prepared to confront any force that could possibly threaten Iran's territorial integrity and interests. Using our indigenous defense equipment, we are capable of defending our soil and will nip in the bud any threat from our enemies.
Situated in a geopolitically sensitive region, Iran holds regular drills as a means to enhance its preparedness in the face of possible threats, such as terrorism and piracy. Iran's armed forces have on different occasions underscored that the country will not be the first to pull the trigger, and its military doctrine is based on deterrence, not aggression.
The 3-day military exercise wrapped up with important messages. On top of them is that Iran is strongly opposed to any foreign presence in the regional waters, describing it as destabilizing and provocative. The Iranian army says Iran and other regional countries are the ones that are responsible for ensuring the security of the region. And this means extraterritorial forces must go home. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drills.
The ongoing Saudi-imposed war has put a further strain on the already fragmented education system of Yemen. In a recent report, UNICEF said more than 2 million Yemeni children remain out of school, as nearly 3/4 of public school teachers in several governorates have not been paid for over 2 school years.
Since the first moment of the Saudi-led war, the educational process has been directly targeted, whether by air raids that targeted the schools and their surroundings, or by depriving teachers of their due salaries. Also, a large number of schools were converted into shelters for the displaced, and some schools were closed because they are located on the front lines of the military battles. All these factors have caused a low level of education for Yemeni children.
The report added that an estimated 1.7 million children are internally displaced and more than 8 million children do not have access to safe water, sanitation or hygiene, which contributes to a growing number of children suffering from acute malnutrition and infectious diseases such as cholera.
It is clear that targeting the educational process is a priority for the Saudi-led coalition, and for this reason, over 7 years, we have suffered a lot. And what helped us is the sense of responsibility on the part of teachers and parents. UN statistics say 2 million children do not have access to education, and 8 million children do not get their most basic needs, and this is a real catastrophe.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led war on Yemen in March 2015, the kingdom has bombed over 1,100 schools and 180 universities in a clear violation of the international humanitarian law that protects educational facilities as civilian objects.
As the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate in Yemen due to the ongoing Saudi war and the blockade, children continue to be the ones who pay the heaviest price. UNICEF describes Yemen as the most dangerous place on earth for children to grow up. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Europe is divided over how to deal with the mounting humanitarian crisis on its borders. Some are calling for walls and barbed wire. Asylum seekers are being used as pawns in political disputes, and desperate people mercilessly pushed back and forth between borders, left to die in the space between with no food or shelter. The UN has called foul, but it seems no one is listening.
Yet the European Union's 28 members seem to be absolutely abysmally hopeless in organizing any kind of real strategy around migrants and their facilitation. And given, of course, that NATO and Europe is at the heart of causing a lot of the kind of migrancy that is a result of conflicts, you'd have thought that they would have had a little bit more in terms of their human rights and their sort of own, moral conscience to do a lot better.
States around Europe's periphery are the first destinations for asylum seekers coming via sea. Greece, Italy and Turkey have been accused of violent pushbacks, and the UK is entertaining the idea of giving border forces immunity from prosecution if migrants die at sea.
All part of this neoliberal, neoconservative, imperialistic worldview, which much of the establishment in Europe has adopted for many, many years now. And it is fundamentally a barbaric, uncivilized, set of policies which show no signs of abating, and backed by that fear that they created within their public on the grassroots level, there's no real pressure on them from the public to refrain from continuing with their witch hunts and their targeting and their scapegoating of immigrants.
However, the UK's border force is refusing to implement the Home Secretary's plan for fear it will lead to more deaths at sea. Priti Patel is trying to introduce a clause to the Nationality and Borders Bill that will see those arriving via irregular routes receive a prison sentence of up to 4 years. But human rights organisers say Europe's compassion for survivors of war is abysmally low, considering the part they play in conflicts around the world.
Countries like France, Italy and the UK have blood on their hands, continuing to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the likes of Israel, the last apartheid on earth, and Saudi Arabia, which has been ravaging Yemen for the last 7 years, pushing it to the brink of famine. Bianca Rahimi, London.
There will be no trial, charges, or even a disciplinary hearing for two police officers involved in killing an 80-year-old woman inside her home with a tear gas grenade. It's the latest example of French cops hurting citizens and not facing even minor consequences. At the start of the Yellow Vest movement in 2018, police were clashing with protesters in the Mediterranean city of Marseille. Algerian national Zineb Redouane was in her fourth floor apartment trying to close her shutters when she was shot and killed. Redouane was on the phone with her daughter at the time of the incident, and she reportedly said, quote, "He targeted me. The police targeted me. I made eye contact with two policemen. One fired at me. Then they got in their car and left," end quote. She died the next day from her injuries.
Et aujourd'hui?
We have suffered repression, which no president has ever permitted in the history of this country. We are not at war. We are not enemies. But the government has waged war against us simply because we oppose their decisions. Just for that, many have paid dearly.
For months, the Interior Minister falsely claimed that the death had nothing to do with the grenade and that she died of cardiac arrest. Half of Redouane's face was collapsed in by the grenade, and she inhaled large amounts of tear gas.
On a subi une répression.
The government has not given one word of apology or one moment of compassion towards any victims of police brutality during the Yellow Vest era. Also, there has not been one word of condemnation for the police who have committed these acts. None of the police have been convicted, even though people have been blinded, crippled, and lost. Of course, our heart goes out to the grieving family, and the Yellow Vest will continue to remember Zineb Redouane and to demand justice.
Her family has sued the Interior Minister and other senior officials for concealing and interfering with evidence. A ballistics investigation by the NGO Disclose suggested that police fired directly at Redouane's window.
Many wonder if there might have been some admission of wrongdoing if the victim wasn't Arab. That appears likely, but she also joins a Yellow Vest-related casualty list, which includes 5,000 people seriously hurt, 1,000 critically injured, scores maimed for life, and 11 other deaths. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
Meet Miqdad Kawasme, a Palestinian prisoner held in an Israeli jail without charge or trial under the regime's so-called administrative detention policy. He's among the six inmates who went on hunger strike in protest of their indefinite imprisonment weeks ago. Sunday marked the 109th day since he last ate. Israeli medics forcibly injected him with nutrients on the 92nd day of its strike. Other hunger strikers are Kayed Al-Fasfus, Ala Arraj, Hisham Abu Hawash, Ayad Huraimi, and Luay Al-Ashkar. The hunger strikers, particularly Fasfus and Kawasme, are grappling with deteriorating health conditions, with Palestinian officials warning that the inmates are at immediate risk of death. On Sunday, over 4,500 Palestinians in different Israeli jails also rejected their meals in solidarity with the six hunger strikers. Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have held sit-ins and demonstrations over the past weeks demanding their immediate release. The United Nations Human Rights Commission has expressed grave concern over the lives of the prisoners. The UN body also criticized Israel's administrative detention practice, calling it a violation of international law. But no word or action is coming from Israel's powerful and influential Western allies. Experts believe the striking similarities they see with Israel to be the reason.
There is a tremendous imbalance of power in the world. And just as we see the tremendous crimes carried out by Western imperialist powers, the ongoing use of illegal sanctions, unilateral coercive measures to starve countries, invasions and occupations, the unstinting support, funding, and collaboration with the Zionist occupation of Palestine is part and parcel of those crimes.
Palestinian inmates regularly stage hunger strikes in protest at their illegal detention and harsh conditions in Israeli jail. What they're fighting for are their most basic and fundamental rights.
Iran's nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, has been in the spotlight for quite some time now, after the U.S. in May 2018 unilaterally withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on the Islamic Republic. In recent months, all eyes have been on Iran to see what approach it takes over the JCPOA after the country's new administration, led by President Ebrahim Raisi, came to power in August.
We support the negotiations that guarantee our national interests, but Iran will not tie its economy and the lives of its people to the negotiations, nor will it allow negotiations for the sake of negotiations. We will not let the negotiations become attritional.
When the administration of President Joe Biden took office in January, Iran and the remaining parties to the JCPOA held six rounds of talks in the Austrian capital before they were suspended in June due to Washington's failure to remove the sanctions. The US and its Western allies exerted pressure on Iran over the past months to resume the talks, but Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said Iran will first review the previous Vienna negotiations and then start talks with Russia, China, the UK, France and Germany, known as the P4 plus 1 group. Just last week, Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani said Iran and the EU agreed that Tehran and the P4 plus 1 start talks on November 29th. He stressed that the talks should result in the removal of sanctions on Iran. The terminology that the Iranian official has used for the upcoming talks attaches significance to Tehran's approach towards the JCPOA. The term start conveys the message that Iran seeks to begin result-oriented negotiations. Talks with the aim of removing sanctions indicates that the revival of the JCPOA and the US return to the deal is not of substantial importance to Iran. What matters is the removal of all sanctions under various titles in action and not on paper. The US has been trying to push Iran to succumb to its demands via the so-called maximum pressure campaign that was launched by the Trump administration following its unilateral JCPOA pullout. But such a pressure campaign has backfired, since Iran has strengthened its defense capabilities, advanced its nuclear program, and begun to enrich uranium to the 60% level. Now, the ball is in the court of the US and its Western allies. They should decide before November 29th on whether they want to take a lesson from the so-called maximum pressure campaign, which top White House officials have explicitly branded as a failed policy, or go on with their anti-Iran agenda. The new Iranian government believes that national interests will be achieved by increasing the country's power. What is certain for now is that the speed of Iran's enrichment shows that the country will not accept restrictions on its nuclear activities in case of non-compliance by the United States.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The tale of two Californias has never been clearer. As San Francisco Bay Area technology workers set up home offices to avoid coronavirus exposure, grocers, farm workers, and warehouse employees in the Central Valley never stopped reporting to job sites. Renters pleaded for eviction relief, while urban officials fled for suburbs and resort towns, taking advantage of record low interest rates to buy bigger and better homes. Most of California State's 6 million public school children are learning remotely, while affluent families opted for private classrooms that are up and running. The article you're about to hear has been written by Mackenzie Mays, a journalist working for the Politico website. The article has been taken from the Politico.com website. The piece is titled Pandemic Reveals Tale of Two Californias Like Never Before. The tale of two Californias has never been clearer. As San Francisco Bay Area technology workers set up home offices to avoid coronavirus exposure, grocers, farm workers, and warehouse employees in the Central Valley never stopped reporting to job sites. Renters pleaded for eviction relief while urban professionals fled to suburbs and resort towns, taking advantage of record low interest rates to buy bigger and better homes. Most of California's 6 million public school children are learning remotely, while affluent families opted for private classrooms that are up and running. California has long been a picture of inequality, but the pandemic has widened the gap in ways few could have imagined. While other states face large budget deficits, California has a $15 billion surplus, thanks to record 2020 gains from Silicon Valley and white-collar workers who pay the bulk of California's taxes. Governor Gavin Newsom unveiled the state's record-high $227 billion budget last week, despite a year in which unemployment soared beyond 10%, and the homelessness crisis reached devastating levels in the city of Los Angeles and beyond. Gavin Newsom has proposed directing much of California's bounty towards struggling residents and low-income families, and it remains to be seen whether the state will continue to reap similar tax rewards in future years. If this is a one-time windfall, Newsom and lawmakers will have to find other resources to sustain additional aid and face pressure to raise tax rates even more on the wealthy. There's a way in which the pandemic has amplified all of these systematic and societal issues we were always aware of, said Brandon Green, director of the Racial and Economic Justice Program at the ACLU of Northern California. These gaps persist and are widening, and if it can happen here, in a blue state where you have the political capital, it can happen anywhere in the United States. California's low-income workers and people of color have borne the brunt of both the economic fallout of the recession and the physical toll of the coronavirus itself. The Latino COVID-19 death rate is 22% higher than the statewide average, and the black death rate is 16% higher, according to California's Health Equity Tracker. Even before the pandemic, zip codes home to just 2% of California's population held 20% of the state's net worth, according to the nonpartisan Legislative Analyst Office. In 2020, more than 40% of households making less than $40,000 annually saw reduced work hours or pay, and an equal share had to cut back on food, according to the Public Policy Institute of California. Decades-long inequalities, those pre-existing conditions around race, around ethnicity, and the pre-existing conditions around wealth disparities and income disparities obviously have come to the fore and must be addressed, Gavin Newsom said whilst outlining his budget proposal last week. Just moments later, Governor Newsom made a stark proclamation about how the other side is doing. The folks at the top are doing pretty damn well, he said. Governor Gavin Newsom, a 53-year-old, is a multimillionaire businessman in addition to being governor, and his own personal life has punctuated the extreme differences in California. His dinner at the French Laundry in November not only enraged the public for his flouting of his own advice against gathering, it served as an optics problem with menu prices that many Californians cannot afford even in normal times. Gavin Newsom sent his own children back to private classrooms in late October, while most California families were stuck in remote learning. When he had to quarantine in November, he said he was blessed because we have many rooms in his Sacramento County home. However, the Democratic governor has prided himself on bridging the equity gap and has branded his efforts as California for All since taking office 2 years ago. He appointed the state's first Surgeon General, Nadine Burke Harris, who has focused her career on addressing childhood trauma in disadvantaged communities and led vaccine discussions mindful of equal distribution. Gavin Newsom has pushed hard to reopen public schools this spring because he says students in low-income neighborhoods are struggling the most with distance learning. Governor Newsom has proposed $600 state stimulus checks to nearly 4 million low-income workers as part of his budget plan. He launched an effort to shelter tens of thousands of homeless Californians in hotel rooms when the outbreak began, and then transitioned towards a program that would convert that into permanent housing. He helped enact renter protections from eviction and wants to extend those protections. Californians saw an array of relief in 2020 as all levels of government tried to lessen the burden. Children who live in communities that have long gone without broadband and quality internet access received hotspots and other Wi-Fi access. Cities stopped using parking tickets and towing as a way to bring in revenue. More lower-level offenders were freed from prisons and jails after the coronavirus outbreak. Advocates say the jarring juxtaposition in the pandemic as the state's richest got richer and its poor got poorer prove it's not enough. They are lobbying Gavin Newsom and the legislature to use California's unexpected windfall to help the state's neediest by expanding the social safety net and to turn temporary relief granted during the pandemic into permanent solutions. They worry that momentum is already losing steam, and that things will revert to normal when the vaccine reaches the masses and COVID-19 is in the past. These things that were implemented as a kind of lifeline are now expiring and folks still need it, said Jehumpa Bhattacharya, a vice president of the Insight Center for Community Economic Development based in Oakland. Bhattacharya added, "We live in a society where we don't believe in government intervention, and there's this narrative that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When the pandemic hit, we saw that's not true. And my hope is that we will be able to develop a new understanding of how our society works." California Democrats have proposed bigger taxes on the ultra-rich as a solution, with groups like the California Teachers Association pushing last year for legislation to hike taxes for residents with more than $30 million in assets. That bill failed, but Assemblymember Luz Rivas just proposed raising taxes on corporations by $2 billion to fund housing for people experiencing homelessness. Governor Gavin Newsom made clear last week that he will not entertain major tax proposals, declaring they're not part of the conversation. The pandemic's remote work culture has shown information-based companies that office location may not matter as much as once thought, while California's high housing cost regulations and taxes are certainly a deterrent. Further taxing the rich is proving to be political risk and a threat to the very system that makes it possible for California to thrive even in dark times. Just last month, Oracle and Hewlett-Packard Enterprise announced they were moving their headquarters to rival state, Texas. Elon Musk, now the richest person on the planet, also said he was moving to the Lone Star State, though his company, Tesla, will remain in California. Advocates say another tax hike is overdue, but even without one, the state could change its priorities to make better use of its billions of dollars. It's all very frustrating since, with the fifth largest economy in the world, these things are fixable. The money is there, said Courtney McKinney, spokesperson for the Western Center on Law and Poverty. It's a question of priorities. Whether or not millions of people being plunged into poverty is seen as enough of a destabilizer to encourage the wealthy, business, and political class in California to put money into addressing poverty and the trappings of poor environment in smart, sensible ways. Easier said than done. Assemblymember Alex Lee, a Democrat from San Jose, a co-author of legislation to extend the eviction moratorium for another year, said resistance to more permanent solutions to help low-income residents is a reminder that California is not as progressive as it claims to be. In the November election, California proved it's not the liberal bastion people think it is. Besides rejecting the business property tax increase, they opposed affirmative action and rent control, while they sided with gig employers and dialysis companies instead of labor unions. Whether or not people should be evicted during a pandemic in a recession, even just having to fight about that says we aren't where we should be yet, Lee said. I think a lot of people are realizing this stuff, and that even though we have Democratic super ultra majorities, we aren't living up to the progressive potential that we have. I would never characterize us as a progressive state.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I feel Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it. And that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma, al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. As Muslims, we need to be very alert, we need to be very aware, we need to be vigilant. The hadith says, al-mu'minu kayyisun fatin. A mu'min is acute, alert, and we are well aware of our surroundings. When you as a mu'min understand that you are a free person, and when you as a mu'min understand that you need to be a free person, you know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, if you remember that saying that where he said that if you don't have any religion that you are affiliated to, and if you don't fear the time of judgment when resurrection is going to occur, then at least be free in your world. Kunu ahraran fi dunyakum. At least be free in your world. Why are you following Yazid? Why are you being allowing yourselves to be slaves of Yazid? We understand that in Islam there are boundaries to freedom as well. You know, you can't transgress the rights of someone else under the pretense that, well, this is freedom and I'm able to do what I wish, I'm able to say what I wish and get away with it. You know, what kind of chaotic society will that be? And that's why there is no government, there's no society that lives on that very wording of freedom of expression. And, you know, that's why we always need to look at it within the clauses that are entailed in those words and not intentionally mislead others, because these words could be used in the negative way, could be used in the positive way. We don't want to be misleading. I think that's very, very important point. Ultimately, what we want to have is we want to lead the society to live a life of safety, live a life of security. If you remember, I mentioned that I'm going to be talking about how Islam condemns terrorizing people and what kind of severe punishment a person will receive if they were to terrorize other people. In our jurisprudence, in fiqh, we can see that there are many cases that discuss the severe punishment of a person who brings about fear in the hearts of the people, a fear-mongering person, whether that be someone who is a thief, whether that be someone who is a highway robber, for example, whether that be someone who is a ruler and is oppressing their subjects, their citizens. لا تروعوا, this hadith says, لا تروعوا المسلم فإن روعة المسلم ظلم عظيم. This is in Kanz al-Ummal. Don't scare a Muslim, because scaring a Muslim is a severe oppression, is a very great oppression. There are a few of these ahadith that speak about danger of bringing about fear into other people. Some of these ahadith use the word Muslim. Some of these words refer to an-nas, or people. And important thing is that we are able to understand that if you were to humiliate or degrade or bring about fear in the heart of someone, if you were to terrorize them, if we could use that word, whether it be an individual, whether it be a collective society, then your hisab is going to be severe, very asir, and the adab will also be very, very severe as well, according to our understanding from these ahadith. شَرُّ النَّاسِ, as the ahadith say.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که رو گفته دارم گفته دی اون امامش گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
We look at why it is that bringing about fear and disrupting the safety and security of people. Now, whether that be you disrupting their social safety or security, or their financial safety and security as well. You know, we have a hadith that is mentioning that also. You can't intentionally do that. Another thing that is very related to this as well is when you are bringing about fear in the heart of a person by not attacking them physically, not attacking them financially by wanting to, you know, cage onto them or, you know, use some kind of monopolizing way to, you know, usurp their rights or things like that. But sometimes you're bringing about fear in them by pursuing their faults. تَتَبُّعْ عَوْرَاتِ النَّاسِ as they say. Or about wanting to expose them. You know, you've got some very personal, private information of theirs, and you threaten them. You know, you want to exploit them. And, you know, this is why this hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, شَرُّ النَّاسِ, the most evil of people, مَنْ لَا يَعْفُ عَنِ الزَّلَّةِ, is someone who doesn't forgive a mistake. Someone made a mistake and you don't forgive it. You're the most evil of people. وَلَا يَسْتُرَ الْعَوْرَةِ, and does not conceal the private parts, which in this case is referring to something that a person doesn't want other people to know about. وَلَا يَسْتُرَ الْعَوْرَةِ شَرُّ النَّاسِ. وَالْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ وَالصَّلَاةُ وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَىٰ سَيِّدِنَا مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِهِ الطَّاهِرِينَ.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.